And now, an ad from Dad.
All right, save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive. Can I take these off? All right. What is this? This looks good. Wow. That's well made. Where did you get this? I'm talking to you with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Welcome to Creating a Family. Talk about infertility and adoption. Today we're going to be talking about everyday choices you can make to increase your odds of getting pregnant with IVF. I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm the director of Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility and Adoption Education and Support Nonprofit, and you can find us online at creatingafamily.org. We're a weekly radio show, and we use the podcast model. That way you can listen whenever and wherever you want, and you can also subscribe. You can subscribe using whatever app you're currently listening to this phone to the show on your phone, or if you're listening through your computer, you can go to the radio page of our website and subscribe there. And that URL is creatingafamily.org/radio show. This show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring is pleased to offer their IVF Greenlight program, providing discounts of up to 50% on select IVF products. All cash-paying patients are eligible, and unlike other programs, there are no financial requirements. To get more information, go to their website, ivfgreenlight.com. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support from our gold sponsors, who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to those struggling to create a family. Some of our wonderful gold sponsors include Manhattan Cryobank. They are dedicated to helping clients have healthy babies by analyzing a client's DNA in combination with the DNA of prospective sperm donors to provide the client with a personalized catalog of safer donor matches. We also have Reproductive Medicine Associates of New Jersey, a recognized scientific and patient care leader in the field of infertility. They have 10 offices and 21 physicians throughout New Jersey. We also have the law offices of James Fletcher Thompson, a South Carolina firm committed to adoption and assisted reproductive law, including providing a gestational surrogacy matching program, as well as legal services for independent surrogacy, egg donation, and embryo donation matters. And Fairfax Cryobank. They have been a leader in sperm donation for over 25 years, and they are dedicated to supplying updated, verified, and accurate medical and personal information on their donors. Today, we're going to be talking about everyday lifestyle choices that you can make to increase your odds of getting pregnant. Our guest today to talk about this is Dr. Alan Copperman. He is the director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, vice chair of the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Science at Mount Sinai Medical Center. He is also the co-medical director of Reproductive Medicine Associates of New York. This is a show that has aired previously, and it was one of our very popular shows. I enjoyed it then, and I think you're going to enjoy it now. So without further ado, I bring you Dr. Alan Copperman. Welcome, Dr. Copperman, to Creating a Family.
Thank you, Dawn. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. We know that a lot of our audience is at the, oh my goodness, I'm not getting pregnant as fast as I thought I would stage. And many of them are still at their OBGYNs or are researching their next step. So today we're going to be talking about some of the practical everyday things they can do at this stage before they start with the big guns of infertility, or while they're researching for a clinic or the right doctor, or if they're already at a doctor and are starting treatment. So along those lines, let me start by asking, how long should a woman stay with her OBGYN before seeking out a specialist?
Well, I think a woman can stay with her OBGYN before, during, and of course after becoming successful with fertility treatments. We really, as infertility specialists, work hand in hand with general OBGYNs. But the important thing is that a patient should take some ownership and really ask the questions to her obstetrician and gynecologist. Now, if you open up the textbooks from 10, 15 years ago, they would say you have to wait a whole year of trying, and then you could start being taken seriously. And I think that we've really evolved over the last decade. A woman that has tried for 6 months, especially if she's over the age of 35, should normally be referred to a fertility specialist, and we should start asking the basic questions. Are the eggs good? Are the sperm good? Are the tubes open? Are we timing things correctly? Are we missing anything that we should be paying attention to? Because with every month that goes by, there is frustration, there's disappointment, there's discouragement, and unfortunately we do get older over time, and there's a lost opportunity that could occur.
Well, I continue to hear from people who are, I'm not sure if they're being encouraged by their OBGYN or if they just don't know, but we continue to hear from people who are staying up to 2 years even, and one of the messages we're trying to get out is that if you haven't conceived after a period of time, and as you say, age matters as to how long that period is, you really should be moving on to a specialist.
Yikes, I really hate to think that patients are still being told 2 years. If a woman is 25 years old, and I think it's okay to try for a year, the chance of getting pregnant is only 15 to 20% in a month. Half of couples should get pregnant in 6 months, 85% within a year. Time is on your side. If a woman is 40 years old, then many of the eggs are no longer normal, and if we're going to be able to help them, it's by seeing them sooner rather than later. So the eggs are certainly not going to be better by waiting, and we may miss this valuable window of opportunity.
Well, we've done a number of shows. Excuse me, I'm fighting a cold here. We've done a number of shows on the timing of intercourse. So although I don't want to spend a huge amount of time, I do want to cover it briefly. So how do we time our intercourse to increase the chances of getting pregnant?
Well, not every woman has a 28-day cycle that's clockwork. So I think one of the things that we need to do is figure out when ovulation is occurring. And if we look back on a month, it's usually 2 weeks before the period. But that doesn't help you when you're in the middle of the cycle. So normally, if you ovulate on day 10 or 11, then a woman should be having sex before then because the sperm should always be there before the egg is released. If a woman is not ovulating until later on in the cycle, well, they can wait a little while longer before that happens. Now, how does a woman know that she's ovulating? Some women feel it in their ovaries as the egg is being released. So, and some women's cervical mucus changes and becomes a bit more watery. Sometimes you can buy a ovulation prediction kit from one of the pharmacies, and there are so many of them that are on the shelves. But I would use all of these to give us information when you're ovulating, but not necessarily to wait for these signs before having intercourse. So the simple answer is having sex before the egg is released and having sex really every 24 to 48 hours. There was a school of thought many years ago that a guy should save up for a whole week so that he builds up his sperm count, and we've really debunked that. Optimal sperm production is 36 to 48 hours for the majority of males. There could be exceptions. There could be guys that need longer, or certainly men that can resume and have a good sperm count with only 24 hours of abstinence. But in general, every other day and before ovulation is a good rule of thumb.
Well, we have a question along that line from, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Luana. She says, Dawn, I heard from one of your old shows about the danger of laptop computers to male fertility. At the time, they were doing more research. Are there any new ideas on if laptops affect sperm quality?
We know that the testicles are designed to hang away from the male body to keep them a bit cooler because that's how optimal sperm production is formed. So anything that could warm up the testicles, such as prolonged jacuzzis or maybe even biking with tight underwear for long periods of time, there are probably things that could be negatives over time and interfere with normal sperm production. But in general, having a laptop on your lap, taking a hot shower, going biking for an hour, going to the gym, if the guy has a normal sperm count and doesn't have anything else wrong, in general, the sperm formation is going to remain intact and there won't be impairment. But it's so easy to check. A semen analysis should be done really early on in the fertility couple's evaluation. We should really know whether or not there's sperm before doing procedures on women, before doing a ton of tests on women, before even doing blood tests on women. So I think that if there's any question, if a couple has a husband that laptop is sitting on his lap 24/7, then sure, we can do a semen analysis and find out whether the heat of the laptop is actually causing any impairment in sperm formation. But I think that that's going to be really rare.
Well, let's talk a little then about male factor infertility. Is there any evidence of specific things that men can do that affect the quality of their sperm, either in terms of sperm count or motility, mobility or morphology?
I think that it's important for men as well as women to be in good physical health, and any medical problems or chronic medical conditions ranging from diabetes, heart disease, obesity, malnutrition, any of these things can affect optimal fertility in both males and females. As far as specific medications, sure, there are anti-blood pressure medications that can decrease the sperm's ability to burrow its way into an egg. The whole calcium channel blocker field. There are chemotherapies that men can be on. So there are a lot of important questions that we should be asking the man to make sure that he is in optimal health. We know that anabolic steroids, for example, can, if a guy is taking them to bodybuilding or any other performance-enhancing medication, can lower sperm count dramatically. But in general, if the guy is in good health and has an adequate nutritional diet, then I don't know that there are super vitamins or other major things that he can do that are going to change his fertility.
There are a lot of supplements available for both male and female. So as far as you know, there's not really any evidence-based support for supplements?
There are a lot of supplements, and there are probably men that need supplements. There probably are women that need certain additional dietary intake. I'm not saying that all supplements or complementary or alternative supplements are not a good thing. I'm saying that for the average couple, we have to ask the questions, are the sperm okay? If the sperm are not okay, then we have to get the guy to see a urologist who is specifically trained in fertility evaluation to ask the question, what's wrong? Is it structural? Is there a varicocele? Is there a tumor? Is there a infection? Is it hormonal? And then once all of these major common causes of male fertility are ruled out, then we can start asking the questions, are there additional dietary supplements or things that we could do to maybe gently assist?
Here's a question from Lillian. She says, we're going to visit both of our families starting tomorrow. Dawn, thank you so much for your show on the holidays and infertility, and especially for your excellent holiday survival guide. I've read it 3 times, and my hubby has read it twice. As you suggest, we're trying to be proactive this year. After listening and reading your guide, we realize that most of our relatives are inadvertently hurting us because they have no idea we're trying to get pregnant. We will be sharing our infertility with family this week, many for the first time. I expect I'm going to hear a lot the suggestion that we should just relax and we'll get pregnant. This seems to be the favorite of my relatives. Since my hubby's family is very pro-adoption, we think we'll hear that we're sure to get pregnant if we adopt. I'd like to be armed with fuel to address these suggestions. Since this show is on everyday things we can do, is there any evidence that just relaxing will increase our chances of getting pregnant, or that adopting will increase our chances? I could probably talk about the adopting one, but why don't you jump in there and talk about, is there any evidence that if you just relax, you're going to get pregnant?
I am so glad you're asking this question. There are so many couples out there who feel guilty, like it's something that they can control when they don't get pregnant. And every time somebody says, oh, just relax, you're too stressed, you're too tense, your body just doesn't want to accept the embryo, it's making that person feel guilty. It's making that couple feel badly. And there's
it's also making them feel more stressed.
Yeah, exactly. But there's no evidence that the emotional state of mind, the level of stress, the level of frustration whether somebody wants it bad enough or whether somebody's relaxed or not is going to affect whether an embryo sticks. If a woman makes a good egg and it gets fertilized by a good sperm, it's going to implant in a normal uterus with a reasonable efficiency, and over time it should work. But I promise you, it has nothing to do whether she's thinking happy thoughts or sad thoughts, and I don't think that family members who suggest, oh, just relax, adopt, sing a song, eat a French fry, any of these wonderful suggestions that are not evidence-based are in any way helpful to the couple. They just make them feel worse. I think that the best things that you could say for those that are listening to the show who are not going through infertility, there are things you could do to be supportive. You can validate the concern. This must be difficult for you. You know that we're here for you. I am hopeful over time. Telling stories about, well, I know somebody who just drank a gallon of Robitussin and they got pregnant. I mean, there are so many old wives' tales related to fertility out there. We could spend an entire whole show debunking them. But the best thing that a family member can do is to be supportive, to be helpful, to listen and to be there and for them. But no, there's nothing wrong with, I mean, I love the fact that couples adopt, I love the fact that there's egg donation and sperm donation and gestational carriers. There are so many ways for a couple to have a baby, but going on vacation, unless that's the only time that the two of them are together when she's ovulating and have the time and the energy to have intercourse, going on vacation is not going to increase fertility. Quitting jobs is not going to increase reproductive success. The body just doesn't work that way.
I always tell people that if just relaxing was enough to get you pregnant, then everybody would get pregnant the first month. When they ditch the birth control, they light the candles and pop the cork, then they would be pregnant. There's also absolutely no evidence that adoption increases your chances of getting pregnant. The reason that people say, oh, I know somebody, is that it is the exception, and we remember the exception. So
you're right. Lillian, over time, even somebody who has a 1% chance of getting pregnant over time because they have a really low sperm count or very few high-quality eggs, over time, there are couples that do get pregnant.
One out of 100 if it's 1%, so yeah.
And everybody tells a story about that same couple who adopted and had a baby, and it just doesn't happen every day. I don't want to discourage people. I think that there are many ways that a couple can have a family. But getting back to the question that you were asking, the answer is not necessarily putting yourself in a positive frame of mind. It's great to be in a positive frame of mind. Anything that one can do to feel positive is positive. If relaxation, if acupuncture, if going to a therapist and learning some new coping strategies, joining a support group, listening to a show such as yours, Dawn, where you're getting information, getting a second opinion, going to see a specialist, all of these things are positive, proactive things that one can do to improve their mental well-being and chances of ultimately succeeding. But that doesn't mean that if you don't do them, that you're doing anything wrong. Everybody's going to find a different strategy.
Amen. Is there any evidence that moderate alcohol consumption, if you aren't pregnant, will help or hurt your chances of getting pregnant? And address that both from the male and the female perspective.
All right, Dawn, it's holiday season. What is moderate?
Well, let's see. I mean, I'm
not going to put you on the spot.
I don't mean me personally. I was going to say what the I believe it's 5 ounces of wine a day for a woman, or let's just say 1 to 2 drinks a day for male or female. We'll make it simple.
I do not believe there is evidence that having a glass of wine, having a cup of coffee, having a Diet Coke, having too much bread pudding on the holidays. I mean, I think that anything in moderation, the body is pretty well equipped to have the human race survive for generations to come. And we've been around for a long time. So I don't think it is that having a glass of wine is going to prevent somebody from making a good egg or having a normal embryo implant. Now, you're never going to find a physician saying, sure, it's a great idea to drink throughout pregnancy, but I also think that there are too many couples that put their entire lives on hold while they're going through fertility treatments. And I would suggest it's okay to take a vacation. It's okay to have a pina colada. It's okay to have a glass of wine while one's trying to conceive. There's no data that will impair eggs or embryos, or on the male side, sperm. Now, somebody, a male who drinks so much that his sperm count is low, so that he can't produce sperm when needed during ovulation, so that there are other marital issues. Now, there are a lot of reasons why one shouldn't drink excessively. But as far as procreation, there's no recommendation that has been made by the Society of Reproductive Medicine or the American College of OBGYNs to have people completely abstain, because it wouldn't be evidence-based.
Here's a question from Carrie, and it's actually one we've never received before. She says, I am a moderate smoker, about 5 cigarettes a day. I absolutely will stop once I'm pregnant, and I think it will be easier for me to stop when I'm pregnant because I will do anything not to harm my child. I have not had much luck when I've tried in the past. We are in fertility treatment right now. We have had one failed IVF cycle. Will stopping smoking now increase my chances of having this next cycle work?
Smoking is a little bit more of a complicated question than alcohol, because here we do have data. We have data that that some of the nicotine products can actually be found around the egg inside of the ovary. We have data that that the nicotine products can impair the cilia, that are the little cells inside of the fallopian tube that that wave the egg and the sperm together, which would be bypassed for in vitro fertilization, but for natural fertility. And we have data that the when you undergo anesthesia for an egg retrieval, for example, somebody who is a smoker is more at risk for getting a bronchitis or even a pneumonia afterwards, because you've impaired their respiratory defense mechanisms. So I'm not sure that a quarter pack a day is a great idea while somebody's going through fertility treatments or trying to get pregnant. And so, unlike the alcohol and caffeine questions where I was a bit more moderate, on this one I'd like to suggest that even those, you know, 5 to 10 cigarettes a day may not be a great idea.
Here's somebody who has asked me not to use their name. She says, my husband is a moderate user of marijuana. He smokes a couple of joints a week. We haven't been able to conceive, and we've been trying a year and a half. His sperm count is fine. I know you're going to tell me we should go to an infertility doctor, and we will be going soon, but I can't help but wonder if my husband should stop all marijuana to see if that helps. He doesn't agree.
Once again, I'm trying to answer questions as scientifically as possible. And so there are certain men that, with chronic marijuana usage, have a lower sperm production, and we can sometimes see this in the quantity or the quality of the sperm or the fertilizing potential. With a normal sperm count, it's going to be hard for the writer to convince her husband that there's anything that he's doing that is impairing their chances of getting pregnant. But again, there's not a ton of data that occasional usage of marijuana is going to be overly detrimental. The easy answer is, sure, stop all behaviors that in any way could impair fertility. But the practical answer is, if somebody is going to use it, the less they use it, the better, and even more than moderation, I'd say minimization of any activity such as this while trying to get pregnant are probably a good recommendation.
Would your answer be different if his sperm count had not been normal? Because a lot of times we
don't
know
the reason.
Well, that would have
been easy. Yeah, that would have been easy.
Okay, because we wouldn't know why his sperm count wouldn't be normal. So how would you answer it? Let's say his sperm count was just by number, it was low.
If we see a guy with a low volume, a low sperm count, an abnormal morphology, trying to get pregnant, he's drinking a few glasses or a few beers a night, and he is smoking a couple of joints a week, the first thing we really want to do is get him tuned up. We want him to optimize his nutrition, minimize these behavioral, these environmental exposures that he has some control over, and then we would want to recheck him. Now, you can't really just recheck them the following week. It takes about 72 days to make a new sperm. So what we look for is a couple of months of behavioral modification and then a reanalysis and some decisions on whether there's anything else that could be impairing fertility.
All right. You're listening to Creating a Family. talk about infertility and adoption, and today we're talking about everyday choices that may increase the odds of success with fertility treatment. Our guest is Dr. Alan Copperman. He is the director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, vice chair of the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Science at Mount Sinai Medical Center, and he is also the co-medical director of Reproductive Medicine Associates of New York. I'd also like to take this time to thank a renewing sponsor, Georgia Reproductive Specialist. He's been a sponsor with us for a year, and they were not quite a year. They have offices in Atlanta, Alpharetta, and Decatur, Georgia, offering the full array of infertility treatments, including IVF, donor egg, and surrogacy. They also have a mind-body program, and they offer a bundle plan, which is multiple cycles for the price of one. You mentioned before, Dr. Copperman, blood pressure meds. It makes me wonder about other common medications, either prescription or over-the-counter, that people might take that could be affecting their fertility and they wouldn't know it. You said blood pressure meds for males. What about for females? And then also let's talk about things like antidepressants and also NSAIDs like Tylenol, ibuprofen, or aspirin. Any of those or any of those that any others that you know of that have had some evidence-based science behind it affecting fertility?
And you ask a good question. When a couple is trying to conceive, we go back to the very basics, and it always comes down to eggs, sperm, uterus, ovaries, fallopian tubes. There are not a lot of other extraneous factors, but for each of these, there could be medications that can have some adverse effects along with whatever beneficial ones the patient is using them for. Antidepressants are generally considered safe, and not only in getting pregnant, but many of them have been proven safe now to use in pregnancy. And it is, if it's important for a patient's well-being and activities of daily life to get some support, both with counseling and with some medications, then most therapists are keeping patients on medication as they're going through this process. Tylenol is completely safe, men and women. Some of the non-steroidals, Motrin and also the whole aspirin group of medications, there have been some studies in high dosages could impair ovulation and implantation, but probably not significantly, and women conceive on these medications all the time. There are medications, certain acne medications, certain chemotherapies, certain hormones that should be carefully evaluated prior to conception to see whether they could either be changed or whether there's a washout period. So it's a bit of a broad question to try to answer without specifics. But men, in general, it's the blood pressure medications. And there's some people that wonder a little bit about Propecia, but even that hasn't been proven for hair loss in men, whether that can affect a sperm count. So I would see a reproductive endocrinologist. I'd evaluate the eggs, the sperm, the uterus, the fallopian tubes, and go through a list of medications, and then with the physician decide what are the best medications to either use or not use while trying to get pregnant.
Well, and we're going to talk about weight in just a minute because we have a couple of questions on that specifically. But before we get to weight, if we can separate exercise out from weight, is there any evidence about either that exercise either helps or hurts our chances of conceiving, either with or without fertility treatment?
I think that the theme of today is moderation, and I'm kind of answering all of your questions with that too. I don't think that there is any evidence that moderate exercise or moderately not exercising is going to be a major factor in male or female fertility. We sometimes see a young athlete, a ballerina, a gymnast who exercises so much that she loses her period. Obviously, that's going to be causing infertility because she's not ovulating. This the signal that gets sent to the brain to tell a woman to ovulate partly is based on the amount of fat tissue that a woman has. So there are certain extremes of low weight or high weight or low body fat or high body fat that can interfere with ovulation and then interfere with fertility. when it comes to exercise, and we're just learning about this right now, there are a lot of people that are trying to understand exercise physiology and how it affects reproductive potential. We normally look at the question of overheating. We know that when the woman is exercising or spinning in a hot room for an hour, she can get her body temperature up several degrees, maybe up to 101 or 102 as she's, if she's overheating, which normally the body doesn't mind that at all. However, if we're trying to get pregnant or in the middle of an early pregnancy, we wonder whether that's an ideal environment for an implanting embryo too. So normally we make some recommendations when somebody is going through the early stages of pregnancy to keep their heart rate to a reasonable level, maybe under 140, to not overheat, to take more breaks than they normally would, to stay well hydrated. Some really common sense recommendations that aren't as evidence-based as we'd like, but they seem somewhat logical.
And that would apply with men as well, one would guess.
Right. Once again, we take a look at the semen analysis, and if we see a problem, then we look at occupational or environmental exposures and body habitus or other behavioral issues that may be contributing to the abnormality, and then we begin to remedy it. With males, it's easy. We could usually see if there's a problem. With women, it's not as clear sometimes whether it is an egg that's not normal or whether it's not implanting or not fertilizing.
Well, now let's go talk about weight. We have a couple of different questions here. The first one is from Timothy. He says, I am overweight but not obese. My wife is also moderately overweight. We are both very healthy. I know that obesity is a problem for getting pregnant, but what about people who have a BMI that says they're a little overweight but are otherwise in perfect health?
I would encourage a couple to look at the and I keep saying eggs, sperm, uterus, and tubes, and if you don't mind my just taking a quick aside, the semen analysis is easy enough to do after 2 or 3 days. If the semen analysis is okay and the man is less than 15% above ideal body weight, so mildly overweight, I really don't think there's anything we need to worry about. As far as a woman is concerned, we check to see if her tubes are open. When a woman would go to the radiologist, they inject dye through the cervix and figure out if the fallopian tubes are open. And we talk about egg quality on the basis of checking somebody's age, because we know that when a woman is 21, 90% of her eggs are normal, which is in her 40s, nearly 90% of her eggs are abnormal. So there is a dramatic decline that occurs over time. So we look at a woman's egg quality, not just on the basis of her age, but we take a history. We do an ultrasound and count how many follicles there are and gives us an idea of how good her eggs are. And we could even do a blood test on the third day of her cycle for a hormone called FSH, or follicle-stimulating hormone. And that measures how hard the brain works to stimulate the ovaries. So if she's got great eggs, the brain doesn't have to work very hard. And if her eggs are fewer or older, the brain makes a ton of FSH, so a high level would be reflective of some egg quality problems. So once we've checked the eggs, the sperm, and the fallopian tubes, now we could figure out whether there is a problem. But I wouldn't just jump to the conclusion that if somebody's a few pounds overweight that it's causing them to be infertile. I would start with with asking the questions: is the timing right? Are the eggs good? Are the sperm good? Are the tubes open? It is rarely those few extra pounds that a lot of people carry.
Now, obesity is another issue, because isn't there some pretty good evidence? I don't know for both men and women, that obesity can affect fertility.
Obesity can affect male fertility because of hormonal imbalances. Female fertility, there could be mechanical issues if both couples, members of a couple, are infertile. And then you worry about pregnancy and delivery, which can also be complicated in somebody who is obese. So optimizing body weight prior to getting pregnant is always a good idea.
Okay, we have a question from Karina. She says, my husband and I are both vegans. My husband has a normal BMI, but I am low normal. I do have regular periods. I am wondering about both our diet and my BMI in affecting our inability to conceive. I would appreciate if you would ask Dr. Copperman. We may be going to see him next spring if something doesn't happen before then. She's asking two different questions. One is her diet, a vegan diet, and the second one is a low BMI, but with regular menstruation.
There's normally nothing wrong with a vegan diet, and every woman trying to get pregnant should probably be taking some folic acid supplementation, even though a vegan diet is going to have plenty of green leafies. I mean, we're going to have some folate in it. But in general, I do not believe that eating red meat improves fertility or not eating it impairs fertility. I think that the vegan diet is almost certainly a non-issue for this couple. Having a moderately low BMI in a woman who's ovulating is also really unlikely to be an issue.
Okay, so probably neither of those would be a problem. You know, as long as we're talking about diet, is there any evidence that eating more veggies or more whole foods is helpful when trying to conceive?
For most men and most women, their day-to-day consumption of food will in no way impact whether or not they get pregnant. And it gets back to this feeling of guilt and pressure and anxiety over the process. There's just not that much control that most people have of whether they make a good egg, a good sperm, or have a normal embryo implanting in their uterus. There are certain conditions, for example, polycystic ovaries, which is a hormonal imbalance that's very common in women, that we sometimes see obesity or acne, oily skin, irregular ovulations, and the characteristic pattern on ultrasound. And women with polycystic ovaries may benefit from taking in fewer carbohydrates in their diet every single day so that they make less insulin and it'll improve their ovulation and may even improve their skin or any facial hair that they've accumulated if those are the symptoms that that woman has with polycystic ovaries. So there are definitely subsets of women that we pay a lot closer attention to, but if we're within ideal body weight, you know, 10 to 15% either way, and we're not talking about another condition such as polycystic ovaries, the day-to-day consumption of food is probably not a major factor. That being said, we have a dietitian who's you know, works with most of our patients on their nutrition every single day in our office, and she helps people maintain a healthy eating style because it's not a bad idea to have people in optimal health before getting pregnant, while they're getting pregnant, and of course when a woman is pregnant, because there are definitely data to suggest that there can be optimal diet at that point.
I'm not going to read these out, but we have two questions. One is talking about the amount of fat in the diet as well as simple carbohydrates. And the other one is asking about high fructose corn syrup. So let me just kind of group everything together, and it may be the same answer you've already given, but let me get it out there.
Yeah, and I would probably say that it's the answer we were just talking about. If a woman does not have polycystic ovaries, or hypothalamic amenorrhea, meaning that she's so skinny that her body doesn't want her to ovulate and get pregnant because it's worried about its own nutritional status. So there are certain conditions that I would say are the exceptions. But in general, I would not spend my time reading the labels to see how much high fructose corn syrup or measuring any of these other factors. For the majority of people, getting pregnant is not really about the actual composition of their daily nutrients. It is really ideal body weight, taking care of oneself, getting some folic acid supplementation to prevent some neural tube defects or other issues later on in pregnancy. Those are the major issues. And getting in earlier rather than later to see a reproductive specialist if somebody's having a problem for a long period of time. It is rarely as simple as modifying somebody's diet.
Maybe because I'm feeling a little sleep deprived myself right now. But I seem to be reading a lot about the importance of sleep for regulating, well, weight, mood, blood chemicals, blood pressure, all sorts of important things. How important is getting enough sleep for increasing your odds of getting pregnant?
There have been some sleep deprivation studies that have talked about the effects on circadian rhythms and ovulation, so that it's a reasonable question to be asking. But for most people, getting 6 hours instead of eight, that's not going to affect whether they make good eggs or good sperm or whether they're going to get pregnant. So I would say that it goes under one of those subject headings that would be great if we can get a little bit more rest and put us in a positive frame of mind, help handle some of the ups and downs, the disappointments, the steps needed to be taken to get pregnant in some cases, but it's not going to cause somebody who's infertile to have a baby or who's fertile not to have a baby. That won't be related to how many hours they got the night before.
It may affect whether or not they want to have sex. It may affect with their emotions, but it's probably not going to affect their basic fertility, is what you're saying.
I agree 100%. I hope that everybody relaxes, has an easy holiday season, gets a good night of sleep, has a great diet, but sometimes life intervenes and people stay up late for work and they don't always have time to have a fully balanced meal, and there shouldn't be a feeling of guilt. That's the reason that that month didn't work, I guess is my take-home point.
And here's an email from Michelle. She writes, "This is a wonderful topic for someone like me who is almost 42 with diminished ovarian reserve. Is there anything one can do to help improve egg quality? I have tried DHEA already. Does diet, herbs, etc. help? This is a little background. I have one bio child at age 36, but we've had no luck with number two. We've done three IUIs, five IVFs at three different clinics." And then she has a separate question, but let me just stop there and ask this question. She has diminished ovarian reserves, which would be fairly typical of a woman who is 42. So is there anything that women can do who either already have it or they know just by their age that they're approaching the age when they would be expecting to have poor egg quality? Is there anything they can do to improve their egg quality?
Unfortunately, if an egg is abnormal, there's nothing one can do to make it into a normal egg. So that doesn't mean that all of the eggs are abnormal in women who are in their 40s, but the whole concept of can I improve my egg quality is one that unfortunately the answer is a simple no. If an egg is not normal, you can't improve it. There are some treatments that we've designed and have made modifications and continue to hone in on that can get us to get a whole bunch of eggs out of a woman. And our hope is that if we can get out 7 or 8 eggs rather than 1 or 2 eggs, then maybe we're going to find that one normal egg and we're going to fertilize it and be able to put it into the uterus and achieve a healthy pregnancy. So there are definitely times that we can help women who are in their 40s, even with diminished ovarian reserve. But no, I do not believe that dietary modifications, DHEA, any of the treatments out there will take an abnormal egg and turn it into a normal egg. Biologically, that's not really plausible because an abnormal egg is one that doesn't have the right number of chromosomes, and taking certain herbs or doing any of these treatments or hormones or things like that are not going to turn it into a normal egg, unfortunately.
What about reducing the rate of decline? Is there anything to say that being at an optimum weight or eating an optimum diet or taking some form of supplement will help with the rate of decline?
It really does not appear that there's anything that one can do to, you know, being on the birth control pill, things like that. They're not really things that we can do to prevent the decline. A woman is going to be born with hundreds of thousands of eggs. She's only going to ovulate about 500 of them in her lifetime. And by the time she goes through menopause, there may still be, you know, a couple of thousand eggs left. But the key is that the majority of the eggs will no longer be chromosomally normal as a woman is in her mid to late 40s. But there is nothing that one can really do to prevent the normal decline in egg quality and quantity that occurs over time. Not to date. I mean, that's one of the things that we're all doing research on, but there has not been anything found to be a reliable preventer of the age-related changes that are inherent to female reproduction.
Well, you've led into the second part of her question. She says, this may be crazy thinking, but if a woman did not take birth control pills all of her life and she, in quotes, wasted the eggs, would it have helped to be on birth control in her 20s and 30s to protect and keep good eggs for later in life? Is this a correct theory?
Definitely not. The birth control pill, I mean, some women even ovulate through it. They just don't get pregnant for a variety of other hormonal reasons. But a woman is going to be recruiting 50 to 100 eggs every single month of her life, whether she's pregnant, whether she's on the pill, no matter what. And some of them will ovulate, some of them will not ovulate, but there's nothing we could do that are going to change these waves of follicular genesis. So there's, unfortunately, unless the woman in her 30s decided to retrieve her eggs and freeze them, then there's nothing that she could do while they're inside of her to prevent them from undergoing the aging process.
We will be doing a show probably in the first quarter of next year on egg and ovarian tissue freezing. So stay tuned for that if this is something that you think you might be interested in. Here is a question from Kimberly. We are going to be, or we will be going to an infertility clinic for the first time after the new year. We expect that I'll soon be on drugs other than Clomid to help me ovulate, and maybe even we will be doing IVF. I want to get my body in as good a shape as I can before I start these drugs. I almost never take any type of drugs, so I am concerned about putting these chemicals in my body. Can Dr. Kopperman suggest things I can do now that will make my body respond better or tolerate these drugs better?
I know that it is such a common feeling to want to do more, to optimize oneself, to be more responsive, and I think it's great that at this caller is asking these questions right now, but it does get back to the answer that I keep coming back to, and that's we just don't have that much control. Somebody who's in good health, takes good care of herself, tries to get to the gym a couple of times a week, has a balanced diet, these are all really about all that one can be doing. The hormones that one takes to try to get pregnant are not as scary as they sound, and I know that there are stigmas that are attached to it, and people sometimes fear the unknown, but most of these, for example, Clomid, it's a pill. You take one or two pills a day for 5 days, and yes, the side effects could be moodiness or bloating, and there's a small percentage of people that who are going to have twins resulting from the medication, but this has been around for 70 years. The babies born are healthy. They don't cause long-term changes in a woman. They don't cause cancer. They don't cause any long-term health hazards. It's not as dramatic a treatment, and I think that starting it and getting all the emotional support during the process are the key things that that one can do for oneself more than any other behavioral modifications.
Well, I think I know your answer to this, but this one I'm going to read. You just got it in from Sarah. She says, we are getting ready for our first IVF cycle in January. This may sound silly, but I am visualizing my uterus lining is growing rich and perfect to receive the embryo. I would like to be doing something else to prepare my body for the transfer. Is there any food or supplement that can affect the health of the uterine lining?
No, and I think that this is great. I think that there's nothing wrong with a mind-body connection, with believing in it, with trying to channel these positive thoughts. As long as if it doesn't work, this is not met with the resultant guilt and anger and frustration, because there's not a lot of data that one can really make these biological effects happen by thinking the right thing. So I think it's okay to be in mind-body programs, acupuncture, and supplements. I don't think there's anything wrong with many of them, but I don't believe that they're a substitute for modern evidence-based medicine, and I don't know that they should be used in, they should be counted on to have a biological effect that hasn't been proven. So I'd be cautious to not put too much weight into some of these channeling positive thought exercises, but I think it would be foolish to ignore the fact that the mind and the body are connected, and the more positive we can be, the better off it will be.
Well, you raised the issue of acupuncture, and that's I wanted to touch on that. I know that there has been some recent research on evidence-based research on the on using acupuncture to increase fertility, or actually, I think the research may have been on using acupuncture to increase the success rate of IVF. Do you know anything about that?
Sure, there have been several articles published in the last year that have supported use of acupuncture in a woman who's making few eggs to try to get them to make more eggs, and for a woman who has failed implantation to get her to implant. And several articles have shown no effects of acupuncture, and some have shown that sham acupuncture, in other words, putting a needle in a wrong place, is just as likely or unlikely to work as putting a needle in the right place with real acupuncture. So, yes, we're starting to scrutinize some of these alternative treatments, but I don't believe that we know the answer. If somebody feels great while doing acupuncture, if it works for them, if they're, it gives them a good frame of mind, and if there's a positive biological effect, then I don't think that there's enough data to say that they shouldn't be doing it. But I don't think that somebody who spends 2 years in acupuncture and on her 43rd birthday finally shows up for fertility treatment has done herself a service, because now we've just missed a window of opportunity where we could have helped her and turned it into a much more difficult situation. So I think at best integrating alternative treatment with mainstream treatment is not a bad thing.
The complementary versus alternative treatment.
Yes.
Here is an email from Brianna. My sister says her cervical mucus was too acidic, and she lowered her body's acidity and got pregnant. I know it may not work, but is it advisable to try to do something like this? If so, how do I lower my body's acidity, or should I just douche with something? My sister avoided citrus, vinegar, and other citrus foods.
And this takes us back to some theories that people had in the 1960s and 1970s that were really pretty much debunked 30 to 40 years ago. The body's acidity, the vagina's acidity, or alkalinity, the dietary consumption of citrus foods, none of those have been shown to affect whether a sperm will live, get through the cervical mucus, up through the uterus, into the fallopian tubes, and fertilize the egg or not. So no, there's no evidence that changing one's diet, douching with bicarbonate soda, or any of these modifications are going to affect fertility in a positive or a negative way.
What about, I remember reading about various forms of douches prior to intercourse that are supposed to increase the odds of the sperm reaching the cervix. Any evidence that anything works?
Absolutely not. In fact, there was even some evidence that overly douching can have bacteria can crawl up and even affect normal fallopian tubes. So there's really no advantages when one's trying to get pregnant.
Well, I do also want to now touch on the issue of recurrent pregnancy loss. For women who have been able to get pregnant but cannot maintain a pregnancy, and in particular, well, I guess let's talk about throughout the pregnancy, but in particular, I wanted to start with talking about those who lose the pregnancy within the first, let's say, you know, eight to first trimester for sure. Is there any type, doctors or patients, I should say, are concerned about doing any type of activity for fear that they could jostle the baby out, fear of having an orgasm or making love in general. Let's talk some about pregnancy loss and things that choices that we make every day that could affect the ability of our bodies to hold on to the pregnancy.
Gosh, you ask about 8 or 9 good questions in there. Maybe we can do a future show on pregnancy loss, because I think that it's a whole other topic.
There are
a lot of reasons why miscarriages happen. Often it is an abnormal egg that gets fertilized by the sperm but doesn't have the exact right amount of DNA, so the embryo then doesn't stick, doesn't develop normally, and miscarries. And that's the most common cause of miscarriages, is the fact that the egg wasn't normal to begin with. But there could be abnormal sperm, or there could be embryos that start off normal but make a mistake when they start to divide. So chromosomal losses are probably the most common cause of miscarriages. There could be something structurally wrong with the uterus. For example, women could be born with an abnormally shaped uterus, or there could be a fibroid or a polyp or some scar tissue that could prevent normal implantation. There could be hormonal irregularities with the thyroid or prolactin, easy things to check for. There could be bacteria lurking on the cervix. And finally, there could be some women that are predisposed to miscarriages because there are clotting disorders. This whole topic called thrombophilias, and they're predisposed to miscarrying because the placenta doesn't get enough blood flow. And sometimes these are easily treatable with things like a baby aspirin and heparin. I could tell you the things that are not associated with miscarriage. Once again, thinking bad thoughts, being stressed out, not really, really wanting to be pregnant at that moment, jumping up and down, and the other answers to your questions. Now, orgasming and having intercourse will not cause a miscarriage. There are certain high-risk pregnancies that we can exercise some caution, but it's really the average first trimester miscarriage is normally an abnormal egg that fertilizes and implants but didn't have the right instructions and just was not able to continue to develop into a normal, healthy pregnancy.
So no amount of activity is going to, or nothing, no choices you make are going to influence at that point the chromosomal abnormality, and the chances of the child being normal are not good, and therefore that's the body's way of knowing that the infant cannot, the fetus cannot survive, of not carrying through with the pregnancy.
Exactly. Normal pregnancies continue with a very high efficiency, and abnormal pregnancies often don't.
If you are concerned about it, number one, of course, you should be talking with your obstetrician or your reproductive endocrinologist. But is there any harm in just reducing your activities, bed rest, doing as little as possible, anything like that? Is there any evidence that that would be helpful? Again, if you don't know the reasons for your miscarriages.
If somebody is having very heavy bleeding and every time she moves, the bleeding increases, then there may be a very small subset of women that we can help them hold on to a normal early pregnancy by changing or modifying her activities. But for the most part, this is something that is not within the control of a woman or any behavior that she will or won't do. So I think that for the most part, quitting work, staying home in bed, those are not things that will improve the chance of having a healthy outcome, and so that's not commonly the recommendation.
Well, it seems like the take-home message is that although there's nothing wrong with trying to be proactive and taking charge of your fertility, if it has the negative effect of making you feel guilty because it's not effective, the chances of things that you're doing every day having a significant impact on your ability to either get pregnant or stay pregnant, it's just not that great. Would you say that's the take-home message?
I think that that is a perfect summary. I think that this really does come down to egg, sperm, uterus, fallopian tubes, appropriate referral to a specialist, and getting any other support that one needs from family and from therapists and nutritionists and anybody else that can be of value. But ultimately, the majority of couples who come in, we are able to help have the family of their dreams these days. I think that the era of infertility is hopefully going to be replaced by an era of fertility where we're going to see success for the majority of people who need our help.
We are certainly hoping that you are completely accurate on that. Thank you so much, Dr. Alan Copperman, for being our guest today on Creating a Family. Now, to get more information on Dr. Copperman or on Reproductive Medicine Associates of New York, you can go to their website. It is RMA, and that's for Reproductive Medicine Associates, NY for New York, rmany.com. If you have found this show helpful, please post about it and link to it so others can listen as well. The show will be archived on the 2010 Big List at the radio page of creatingafamily.org, and it's also available for download as a podcast from iTunes. You can go to the iTunes store and find it there, or the easiest way to find it on iTunes is to use the iTunes button on our radio page. Just click on that button. It'll take you directly to the page on iTunes, and you can download it without charge there. To stay in touch with the latest developments in infertility and adoption, and as well as the upcoming week's blog and show topic, sign up for our weekly newsletter at any of the pages of creatingafamily.org. Next week's show, December 29th, will be on the mind-body connection with fertility. Thank you for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
The all-new Toyota RAV4 asks, what if your ride was refined and rugged
at the same time. Introducing the all-new RAV4 Hybrid. 208 combined horsepower and standard all-wheel drive make it the most powerful RAV4. Plus, with its head-turning style and breakaway speed, it's bound to change the way you think of a hybrid. The all-new RAV4 Hybrid. Toyota. Let's go places. Horsepower. Ratings achieved using the required premium unleaded gasoline with an octane rating of 91 or higher. Premium fuel is not used. Performance will decrease.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the... Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.